First of all, the title of this talk is Without a PowerPoint. Wow. So this is what it's like in here. It's the first time I've actually been on site during this entire symposium. I've been a virtual panelist up until now, because our subject this afternoon is the institutionalization of feminism, which to me includes the old idea of inside and outside. I've wanted to see and feel what all of this feels like from the outside. So really, all yesterday and until this afternoon, I've been listening to the proceedings on the web radio, on WPS1 Art Radio. And I gotta tell you, sometimes it's surreal, because when the web kind of overloads, you're just left there in mid-sentence. Or when there's a lot of visual going on again, but it's kind of great because your whole imagination starts to flood. What are they showing? What are they? So it's kind of a great way to see it. And the other thing I guess that I wanted to say is that this is also dedicated to the people who are listening to this on the radio. So, as we were listening, I've heard so many panelists say how great it is to be among so many speakers who've done so much important work over the last 30 years, which is, of course, true. But not being an academic, not being an artist, it's also intimidating, which I guess used to be the old point of institutions. The question is how to approach the subject in a new way. The radio is a good metaphor for the journey I want to take with you today, as it has much fewer walls. For me, the radio has played an enormous role in how I develop my own consciousness about institutions and institutionalism. Growing up in South Africa in the late 50s and early 60s, the radio was one of the few connections we had to the outside world. Apartheid was full on. There was no television. Books that were considered incendiary were banned. Any kind of political gatherings that opposed the system were forbidden, and on it goes. Apart from those who were in prison, one of the only official oppositions to the system of apartheid, the institution of apartheid, was represented by one woman, Helen Suzman. And every time she spoke on the radio, we'd sit around and listen to her. A few years later, when my family was living in exile in Scotland, and I was going to an all-girls school, the radio again helped me feel not so alone. Dusty Springfield's smoky voice singing, "I just don't know what to do with myself," came sailing through the air. Something about it, maybe the fact that you couldn't tell if it was a man or a woman, or white or black, hooked me. Years later, I realized that part of the attraction was the intangible secret code of exchange that has been so strong between gay people before they could feel safe to live their lives above ground. I didn't know I was gay yet, and I certainly didn't know anything about Springfield's private life, but somehow I got the message listening to that song. Finally, the radio played a part in the only time in my life when I've come close to being a performer. Frankly, this footnote in my biography was tucked away in the not active part of my brain. Then a few months ago, I received an email from an old pal, Martha Wilson, the founder of Franklin Furnace, which harked back to our lives in the late 70s. She reported that the band we'd been in back then was going to be included in WAC, Art and the Feminist Revolution, at the Museum of Contemporary Art in LA this March. My reaction went from laughter to, oh no, to what else is in the show. And I've cut out the part of my, where I was going, really to talk about the kind of the issues, of course, of representation and writing of history, and you've all talked about that so much that I'm gonna go right back to Disband, the name we'd given our group, and it says it all. We were part ironic, part dead serious. We invented as we went along, and we barely rehearsed. After all, how much practice does one need to play the radio, which was my instrument of choice? The truth is, I thought we stunk. But that was kind of the point. We were the anti-band, deconstructionists, really, before there was a word for it. We were even fired for being unlike the band that was expected in Florence, in the middle of our so-called European tour, as the opening act for Laurie Anderson, by an intensely full of himself fellow in charge of the performance festival which had brought us there, who screamed, "But you're terrible." But we didn't care. The insult only fueled us. And anyway, we didn't lack for gigs. Our bookings covered the gamut, from appearances at the newly christened Women's Building in LA to Manhattan joints like the Mud Club, which was mixing up uptown and downtown and art and fashion and music. And we were also invited to perform at the Art Institute of Chicago, the Whitney Museum, and many other so-called bastions of culture. We were never, however, asked to play here at MoMA. But back then, I was coming here every day anyway, as I had an NEA curatorial internship in the Department of Photography. One of my favorite jobs was when I got to go down to the galleries before the museum opened to make sure the glass in front of every photograph was clean. Another little thing I used to do is I was very interested in who got spat on the most. Anyway, I'd go with some rags and a spray bottle of Windex, making up new disband songs in my head as I went along. I confess, whenever I came across a picture by a woman, Arbus, Modell, Abbott, I'd give them an extra spritz and shine up the glass with an extra effort. Anyway, after a couple of years, disbanded, true to our intentions and our name. I can't speak for my fellow bandmates, Martha Wilson, Alona Granite, Donna Hannes, Diane Tor, Dale Kaplan, and an occasional drop-in visit from Barbara Kruger and April Gornick, but our dissolution was fine with me. I thought we were much better as an idea than in reality. Anyway, our product was beside the point. What mattered was what happened when we hooked up. Despite how different we each were from each other, we were bonded because we knew that even though it was intensely embarrassing, putting ourselves and our narratives on the line out there in public was part of a collective dream connected to the changes that women were calling for, not just in the art community, not just in one aspect of the art community, not just in the culture around us, but across the world. And in my mind, that's why we had to stop before we became a brand and institution. To me, the feminist movement back then was about movement, not stasis, and letting in all kinds of noise, which it still is to me, which is why I played the radio, turning its dials and letting in whatever frequencies its antenna picked up. Thinking about this panel, I realized that this perspective, combined with an almost reflexive distrust of institutionalization, has informed everything I've ever done. So if you'll bear with me, I'm going to revisit quickly a few of the pieces I've written over the years that crisscross with my own interests in high and low, and also with the broader subject of the institutionalization of feminism or other related histories. For the purposes of today, I've taken these pieces, felt completely free to tweak them and scoop out a few chunks. I've also thrown in some new subtitles. An instance of the institution as gravedigger, but also as incubator. How many artists have passed through the world without being noticed? How many got a flash of attention and that was it? Over and over, we hear about the same artists. But what about all the others, the unknown, the uncelebrated ones, who far outnumber those whose work has stayed visible and valued? Among the uncelebrated ones, how many never had a chance just because luck wasn't with them, because they weren't in the right place at the right moment, they weren't the right sex or the right race, or they weren't interested in the right sex? Look at what happened to the photography of Clementina Lady Hayworden. Hayworden's entire body of work was made in 8 years, from 1857 to 1865, when she died at the age of 42. Soon after her death, except for a few photographs that she herself had sold or given to friends, and that eventually ended up in private public collections, her work was out of sight. Her photography turned into a secret because almost all of it was passed down within her family. after Hayward's granddaughter, Clementina Tottenham, gave the family pictures to the V&A in London in 1939, the work really went out. This gift was a windfall, but by then no one remembered Hayward. There was no demand for what she'd accomplished. Back in the 1860s, for a season or two, her prints had been singled out when they appeared in group shows, winning her compliments, silver medals. But in 1939, she'd been dead for almost 75 years, and her reputation was buried with her. So the photographs collected dust in the V&A. Landing in museum storage is only one of the reasons that Hayward's photography was almost lost to history. Another factor was a lack of interest in her kind of work, which is one reason why the museum shelved her photographs in the first place. Mostly, Hayward took pictures of her daughters in fancy dress, family photos, a genre that has historically been thought of as unworthy of serious attention. And they were born of one of the few things in life in which women have traditionally been granted more opportunity for self-expression than men dressing up. When Mark Haworth Booth, curator of photography at the V&A, assigned a graduate student, Virginia Dodier, to go through the museum's Hayward material, she had an art historian's dream job. Almost nothing was known about the 800 or so Hayward pictures or the woman who took them. It was Dodier's detective work that eventually led to a catalog resume and to Hayward's first exhibition in 130 years. It's unlikely that the pictures will soon be let out on the road again. The darkness that enveloped them all those years in storage turns out to have been healthy in terms of their physical protection. Like most photographs made in the early days, they don't like light. The institution almost killed them because it buried them, but paradoxically, it was being interned that saved them. By the time they were resurrected, they had not only an audience waiting, but the technology that could preserve them. Another subhead, an instance of the institution as straitjacket, but also as pleasure giver. If you ask your Japanese feminist friends about Takarazuka, you risk being laughed at. They may tell you that their mother likes it, but that they themselves have no interest in it at all, that they've never seen it and have no desire to, which may explain why, although I'd come upon mention of Takarazuka in print, it took years for me to actually see it. As it happens, I had a passing encounter with a phenomenon 10 years ago in Tokyo. Looking out of a window, I actually wrote this in 1992, so it would now be almost 20 years ago. Looking out of a window in the Imperial Hotel across from the Tokyo Takarazuka Theater, I saw an enormous crowd on the street below, obviously waiting for something. I can't remember whether or not I noticed that the throng was female, but I do remember being aware of how orderly and disciplined it was. At the hotel information desk, I asked who the people were and what they thought they were expecting to see, and was told with a dismissive laugh, "Oh, those are the Takarazuka fans, all women, all girls." I completely forgot about my aerial view of Takarazuka until I went with a friend B to see the company perform at Radio City Music Hall in 1989 when it was on tour. The Radio City event contained many standard elements of Takarazuka. There was singing, dancing, acting in a surreal mixture of East and West, and the women played both female roles and male roles. Dot, dot, dot. Back in Tokyo, a few years later, we made straight for the Takarazuka Theater and acquired standing room tickets, the only ones left for a performance already in progress. I can't remember ever being so stunned by another sequence on stage as I was by the finale of Takarazuka's version of Spartacus, which we saw from our perch in the third balcony. Spartacus and his cohorts are surrounded by Roman soldiers led by an evil general. The heroine, Spartacus' great love in blue chiffon, snatches a sword and kills the general and is slain in turn. The bodies are borne away and Spartacus is left alone on stage to sing a dirge of protest, anguish, and heroism. The music, which made Andrew Lloyd Webber's button pushing seem really subtle, was accomplished by another sound, a subdued weeping throughout the huge house, which couldn't be muffled by the white handkerchiefs that had been pulled out and put to use by the audience. The dirge ended, the lights went down, and the lights came up on two lead performers. How could one possibly quibble about technique or talent or narrative logic in the face of the kind of pleasure we saw all around us? This was a full-scale, all-out performance for an audience of fans who are crazy about the company, who plan their lives around getting tickets for it, who have favorite stars they wait for hours on the street to see, and not just wait, plan the wait, choreograph the wait, treat the wait as a ritual that leads to paradise, the sight of them. Of the many people we talked to, only one group seemed uninhibited by the fact that I identified myself as a reporter from New York with a tape recorder in my hand. This group was made up of fans wearing no special uniforms and standing in one unprestigious spot far from the main entrance. An older woman in the group showed a boldness that seemed to encourage the others. "Why do you think so many people love Takarazuka?" I asked. "Because they're more manlike than real men," they answered. A pair of twins in their mid-20s had been listening to our conversation, and one of them put in, "And they're more delicate than real men. The charm is that we all know they're women, and yet they're like men." The older woman added, "And they sing better than men, anyway." When I asked one uniformed woman how her fan club's favorite star behaved at its get-togethers, she said, "Our star doesn't make any speeches, she doesn't give any lectures, we ask questions and she answers." A couple of days later, we received what we'd been hoping for, a fax from Haruko Saka, the president of Takarazuka, inviting us to visit the company at its headquarters in Takarazuka City. We asked Mr. Saka what determines whether a girl is to play male or female roles. "Height," he said, and he added, "depending on the girl's physical type, on the type of body that she has, she is advised whether she's right for a male or a female role." It had begun to seem as if we were discussing broncos that needed breaking in and not schoolgirls, but I went ahead and asked how the disciplining is done. I was expecting almost any answer than the one I got. "When the girls enter the school, we bring in members of Japan's self-defense forces. These men provide basic training. They teach the girls how to walk, how to keep a straight posture without moving, how to bow. All these things are managed by the gentlemen from the self-defense forces." The administration was very precise about the cost of the girls' education, but the answers got fuzzier when it came to other costs, such as the emotional toil of the commitment to Takarazuka, which is required from the students. There doesn't seem to be much concern about the girls' psychological states, nor is there any kind of social programming. No one talks about anorexia or drugs or condoms. There are no guidance counselors or therapists available. We asked if the students had any special person they could go to for advice when they had worries or personal problems. When we asked what these matters might typically be, the example we were given was a sore leg. And when we asked Mr. Saka what qualifications he had to be in charge of the young women who came to Takarazuka, he told us that he'd once worked for the railroad company and been in charge of scheduling arrivals and departures. And he was proud to say everything had run on time. How much more? Okay, then I'm going to skip the next few ones, okay? And just pretend I've read a few more. Over the years, it's been from putting myself in environments like these, things about which I knew nothing before I wrote about them, that opened up new ways for me to think about institutionalism. The artist Kusama is another one. In the late 50s, the happenings at Kusama stage when she was working in New York could be described as nothing short of revolutionary. I know she's been discussed here, so I'm not going to go in there, but I'm going to include. When I asked her what it was that drove her, she said, "I had a phobia about sex, and in order to overcome and release myself from those fears, I made an uncountable number of phallus-shaped pieces. Donald Judd, who lived upstairs from me, would come help me make them, sewing and stuffing thousands of pieces. And then I put them on all kinds of things, from chairs to boats to dishes to cups and whatnot. I presented these pieces as obsession rooms, compulsion furniture, forms of patience or sex and food obsessions, and labeled my art psychosomatic art. Kusama's self-obliteration pieces have always haunted me, as has the fact that she went into an institution soon after her arrival back in Japan in the early 70s. Since then, she has basically lived a double life, going to her studio by day and passing the night as a voluntary resident in the psychiatric hospital. A couple of years ago, when I was in Japan and met with her, I asked her why she lives this way. She answered, "It's where I feel safe." Maybe this is the duality that we as feminists have to live with at this turning point in the institutionalization of feminism. It's a danger zone, but it's also the only harbor we might have.